time travelers, and welcome to a very special first time we ever did this edition of Biblical Time Machine. Helen, we recorded a live podcast session at the SBL Global Virtual Meeting in front of a live audience of, I want to say, 12 people?
I thought you were going to make something up, like thousands.
12. No, exactly. You didn't let me finish. People. 12,000 people, as far as we knew. I only saw 12. Here's what I understand. The meeting, it's global. People from around the world register for this thing. And since they're all in so many different time zones, that people generally just kind of watch the recorded sessions afterwards. So I'm sure 12,000 people will watch it eventually. The live part maybe wasn't as thrilling. I didn't hear a lot of roars.
It's quality, not quantity. They were 12 really good people. And really, you know, Jesus, people. He had 12. That was fine for him.
Perfect. I did not think of that. Just following Jesus. It was fun, and we were very excited to talk with Matthew Larson about prisons in the ancient world. I guess specifically kind of prisons in the Roman Empire and in the ancient Roman world specifically. Did you come away thinking that prisons were as foul and disgusting and terrible as you assumed that they would be in the first century, Helen?
Prisons were not a place that was high up on my list to go to with the time traveling machine. Matt did a great job of sketching in even more disgusting bits and pieces and bringing the whole thing alive, and also the reaction of other people to prisons and how they fit into the sort of the social dimension of everything. You know, how you got your food in prison and scribes and people and how they hung around. So yeah, no, it just really kind of brought the whole thing to life. So it was a great discussion.
Yes. Yeah. We took our launching point from, you know, Paul and Peter, man, who else? Like tons of the apostles and other early Christians were imprisoned. And so that's kind of, we're trying to figure out what was it like for them? How do they write letters from prison? How do they get food and all these things? And Matt, you know, he's on this really cool research journey. It's called the Prison Project. And they're going around to like 30 different archaeological sites and making scale models of these ancient prisons. And maybe 3D models, maybe not scale models. They're not making them out of popsicle sticks, which would be a lot of fun. Making 3D models to better understand. I don't know. It's really cool. We get into it in our conversation. So this will be a little different than usual. I am going to just kind of jump over to the recording that they made at SBL of our live podcast session, and we will take it from there. And one more thing, if you are a member of the Time Travelers Club, we are going to post a video from that session. So you get to see our beautiful faces as we talk about ancient prisons. So if you are not currently a member of the Time Travelers Club, please go to the show description where we will have a link where you can find out how to support the show with a monthly contribution. We really appreciate all of our Time Travelers Club members. So go over to Patreon and check out the video from this conference. All right, well, let's get to the recording of our live podcast with Matthew Larson about ancient prisons. Well, welcome, everybody. Thanks for doing this. This is our first time recording a live podcast episode, so we are excited about this. My name is Dave Roos. I am a co-host of Biblical Time Machine. I'm a journalist. I am not a biblical scholar like the rest of you, although I try to look very scholarly with my glasses. my awesome co-host, you guys probably know her, is Helen Bond. Helen is a professor of Christian origins at the University of Edinburgh. I will be introducing Matt here in 1 second, but we thought we'd give you a little background about the podcast if you are not already familiar with it. We kind of say that the podcast, we travel back in time, although we really do travel back in time. It's complicated, but we travel back in time to explore the fascinating histories behind everything we know from the Bible. So we're talking about the characters and events And the texts themselves, kind of how do these things come together? And so we've done 60 episodes of the podcast. We started in October of 2022. We have new episodes every Monday if you want to check it out. We are on all your major podcast platforms. And we're excited to be at this meeting because we do have, we're content partners with SBL. SBL has that really cool website, Bible Odyssey, which I'm sure you guys are all familiar with. And I think what we do on our podcast is very much in line with Bible Odyssey. We're just sort of trying to present, you know, really interesting biblical scholarship, you know, for a broad general audience. So we try to keep it at that accessible level and kind of tell everybody what all you guys are up to out there.
Today's podcast topic is a perfect example of the type of subjects that we love to cover on Biblical Time Machine: prisons in the ancient world. The more gory and dirty and smelly it is, the more we like it. Readers of the New Testament know that Paul was imprisoned several times, as were Peter, John, James, Silas, and Philip. Paul even mentions a female disciple, Junia, who was imprisoned with him. So we'll get to all of those in a few minutes. But our question is, what were prisons actually like in the Roman world? Were they anything like modern prisons or jails, or were they much, much worse?
Yeah, we're talking about prisons today. Every episode of the podcast, we have to track down, you know, the top scholars working on this. And so we were very excited to welcome Matthew Larson to the podcast. I'll give you a little background about Matt. Matt's a historian of ancient Christianity and ancient incarceration for our purposes. That's the most important part. He's an associate professor of New Testament at the University of Copenhagen, and he is the principal investigator for the Prison Project. So maybe we could start there, Matt. Well, first of all, welcome to Biblical Time Machine. We're very happy to have you with us.
Thanks, Helen. Thanks, Dave. Really happy to be here. Yeah, let's get started.
Yeah. Tell us about the Prison Project. What, you know, I was reading a little bit about it. It sounds like you guys are trying to answer some questions and fill in some holes in history that we have not looked at before in regard to the history of prisons.
Yeah. So we're wrapping up our first year of a 3-year project at the University of Copenhagen, looking at the materiality specifically, or the archaeology of prisons and incarceration. And the reason for that is for a lot of reasons that I suspect we'll probably talk about in the podcast. Prisons have been kind of understudied by people. And when they have been studied, they tended to be studied as though they're kind of a modern invention. Mm. And, you know, one of the kind of quotes from a famous sociologist that I like to drag out and kind of show and say the need for this project is Didier Fasson wrote a book. And the first sentence is the prison is a modern invention, period. No footnotes. Mm. Let's move on. And of course, people who study the New Testament or early Christianity, immediately bells might be going off in the back of your head. Like in my fourth year of my PhD, so I'm actually finishing a dissertation, I hear this line and I'm like, that's a weird thing to say. Like I could probably tell you like 40 examples of people who spent significant time in a prison in early Christian texts, both in the New Testament and the subsequent centuries. So I'm like, well, that doesn't make sense. And then you look around and some people have actually looked at this a bit, but when they've looked at it, they've tended to say, we have no archaeology of prisons.
Wow.
And I have thought that also strikes me as strange. I mean, and on the one hand, I get it. It's like, it might be hard to identify a prison and what makes a prison different than like any other ruin that we're looking at. But on the other hand, like if the kind of famous Roman architect is right, that every Roman town that had a forum would have had a prison, then we should expect there's like thousands. And so I started digging and realizing, actually, we do have a lot of evidence of prisons. Okay, maybe not a lot, but it's growing. you know, actually, I just got back last night. I am insane. And so drove from southern Sicily to my home in Copenhagen.
You drove? Wow.
How long does that take?
30 months. No, 30, about 30 hours.
Oh, wow.
But we were in a town in Sicily. We were looking at a structure that is of interest. And while we were there found some evidence that I think is likely to add at least one more number to the list of sites that we can say, which is going up towards 40 or 50, depending upon how kind of secure we want to identify it. So the goal of the project is basically to say, like, what did a prison look like? It's if you can't answer that, a lot of these basic questions about Paul or John the Baptist or Jesus or Epaphras or all the list that Helen went through and many more, it's kind of like saying, I study the Bible and you've never seen a codex, you know, which is a topic that in New Testament studies people are familiar with. Like, of course, you need to know what a codex looks like if you're going to talk about the history of the Bible. You know, well, if we want to talk about the history of prisons, you have to know what a prison looks like. But we're also interested really in foregrounding the experience of prisons. And for me, I'm sort of animated in my work on this by people like Michelle Alexander, her book, The New Jim Crow, and seeing mass incarceration in the United States as really a significant political and moral failure and problem. And so for me, I'm animated by wanting to foreground not just what did lawmakers hope would happen, but what did actual communities experience? And so looking at, of course, the architecture, but also like graffiti, paintings, inscriptions. We've got a database of about 300 different documentary papyri or sources on prisons that the project is compiling. So that's kind of the goal of the project. And we're a team of me and then two other people who are full-time with the project and then three others who are affiliated with it on a non-full-time basis.
I can't wait to get into the nitty-gritty of all of this. But maybe just to start us off then, can you tell us what were some of the different kinds of incarceration that you get in the Roman world? Was there anything that we would recognize today as a prison, you know, a separate building, chains, bars at the windows? Bars, you know, what would a prison have looked like?
Yeah. Well, you have lots of different kinds of prisons. And this is something that we're trying to untangle. And we kind of already knew that, you know, just from looking at a source that's pretty well known, like the Passion of Perpetua. So from dated or at least set and maybe written, depending upon who you ask, in the early 3rd century, around 203. Well, she's under house arrest first, and then she's in a civic prison, and then she's in a military prison, and then she's incarcerated in the amphitheater. So even in just in that story, you've got four different kinds of prisons. But the question of what did a prison look like, you can kind of talk about on two levels, right? So like what did it actually look like on the archaeological, based on the archaeological record, so the architecture, and then what did people think it looked like, right? So just like today, if I showed you a database of 100 actual prisons, that's one thing, but to ask what the general public thinks a prison looks like, those are two different things. And so we have examples of both in Pompeii, where we also were last week with my team. They've got three different paintings of a mythical story that's set inside a prison. Oh. And that painting is really important for us because the prison is not the point. The prison is the kind of subconscious assumed background, right? It's as if you like hired an artist and said, hey, tell this story and just paint it in the back of like a prison, you know? So then you're kind of getting a generic sense of what a prison looks like. And you've got a thick wall and usually a barred window, and it's underground and it's dark and light is streaming in from above. And in one of them, you have the prison guard looking in from outside the window. So you have some interesting, you're able to get some kind of a sense of what a prison actually looked like. And there you can extrapolate to what it would have felt like and been like to be inside of one.
Wow. So yeah, what is the relationship? So you said we know something about the architecture, but then you have this sort of imagined, you know, interior of a prison. So do they match up, or what are some of the differences that you've been able to see? Like, is that image of the light streaming through the barred window reflected in some of the archaeological findings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're probably not at a number where we can talk about a generic prison. But, you know, if the number grows, if our model holds and the number grows, you could say your generic prison is a building that is attached to the forum, that is underground, and that has a window or opening to a public street that light would have streamed in from. And that window would have been really important because That's you would have gotten visitation and food and supplies from your friends through that window. But basically, they do look like dark underground spaces. I mean, some of these, we were re-excavating a site in, it's called Kosa, and this was maybe 4 years ago. And so we spent weeks inside of one of these sites, and you really kind of got a sense of like, it's really humid. It's like cold, and yet I'm sweating, and there's like bugs, and it smells bad, and I smell bad. And you kind of get a sense of like what these sites were like. And it kind of maps onto what we see in literary sources. Although the one thing I would add is that we know of a couple prisons that had a toilet facility, but most would not have. And so when these literary sources talk about a stench or something being what usually is translated into, you know, 20th century English as foul, I mean, what they're talking about is these places would have been just like lined with feces and filth and dirty people who were barely clad, and all kind. They would have been extremely. I mean, you want to talk about a biblical time machine? Like, I tell students, like, if you could go back to the first century, first of all, you'd probably be dead within a week because of your system.
We've realized that.
Yeah, and secondly, you would be entirely bowled over by the stench.
Yeah,
and the prison is. It would have just been a very fragrant part of the urban landscape.
I mean, for even for these literary sources to like call that out, for them to even to recognize that something smelled bad, you have to imagine like how much worse did it smell than just regular life?
So yeah.
That's real smelly.
Exactly.
And is there any significance? You say that there's the window that's going onto the public street, and we'll come on later to how people could, you know, pass things over, food and things like that. But is there a sense that there is a publicness to this, that you know, you can hear the cries or whatever of the person inside? Is that a part of the thing that people walking past sort of get a sense of, oh, you know, there's something horrible down there?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, it's hard for me from the documentary sources, you know, so basically like actual prison petitions or the literary sources, archaeological visual, to imagine that anyone living in a city in the Roman world didn't know where the prison was. That they would have known, and they would have regularly walked by, even if they didn't know anyone, and seen these kind of like shadowy faces. They would have seen. Yeah, I mean, not shadowy face, but a shadowy space and faces looking out. And they would have smelled it. They would have, it is, the term I use is it's an imminent invisibility. So they're very close, but they're carefully made invisible, right? And this is something that I can probably say on a podcast like this that I wouldn't yet know how to publish in a peer-reviewed journal. But the prisons that I have been inside tend to have a sort of reverse auditorium effect in the sense of you can hear what's happening outside, but you can't be heard outside. It's easier to hear the voices from 50 meters away. Whereas if I'm shouting full throated from inside, people outside can barely hear me. So you probably do have a sense of you are very much in the middle of the city and very much invisible and unhearable to the city.
And that would just make the experience worse, wouldn't it? I mean, how horrible to feel that daily life is going on and you're just sort of blotted out almost.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a graffiti. This is much later from late antiquity in Corinth, but Christian graffiti. And it's on a floor tile and they sketch an ear into the floor tile. And then it's made by like four different people. So it's sort of like a collective technology for... And it said, there's an ear, and then it says, Lord, hear your slave. And what's interesting is it doesn't give a name. So it's sort of like, by not giving a name, it's a technology that anyone in the prison could use, right? So, and I think that speaks to the sense of like, I can't get a trial, and I literally can't be heard outside the walls as well as I would like. And so this technology, I'm calling it a technology, but it's a place where prisoners, incarcerated people would have the chance to sort of speak something into someone's ear, even if it was just a stone on the ground.
Well, okay, so let's go back to something we could relate this to in the New Testament. I mean, Paul, maybe the most prominent figure that gets imprisoned a few times. What can we tell from the clues in the New Testament text, you know, what do we know about maybe what type of imprisonment, what type of incarceration was Paul experiencing in a couple of these different, you know, places that he was imprisoned?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we can say is we get two different kinds of pictures of Paul in prison, one from the Acts of the Apostles and one from his own letters. And there's a book that I would commend to the people watching this by Ryan Schellenberg called Abject Joy, where he draws out that in Acts, Paul is portrayed as a Roman citizen and therefore shouldn't be punished in these ways or put in prison. And so he appeals and he eventually, this is how the gospel makes its way to Rome. In Paul's letters, he talks about he's being imprisoned all the time and he's being beaten. And that is something that would not likely have happened to a Roman citizen, or it shouldn't have happened to a Roman citizen. And Ryan Schellenberg points this out. So on one level, that is one aspect of it. But what's interesting about, we have two, what New Testament scholars would call undisputed Pauline letters. And that would be Philippians and Philemon. Those are ones that just about no one would question the historical person Paul himself. Actually, well, he didn't write it. He probably spoke it through a window. And what's interesting about those is he doesn't give too many details about his incarceration. He doesn't kind of give us the sort of laundry list of, hey, you probably want to know what it's like in here. Let me complain or tell you this. And so what I talk about with my students is it's more useful to use this database of information to read Paul than it is to read Paul to inform us what Roman prisons were like. I mean, if all we had was Paul, it'd be like, sometimes they're in a praetorium and it's not fun. And you know, there's not a ton, but actually if you understand this context, both the archaeology and the documentary sources, his letter, like the letter to the Philippians, takes on a really different shape. And I think we can understand it in a different way.
So does Paul's imprisonment match what we know about incarceration in the Roman world? I mean, is it mainly sort of short stays awaiting trial or for maybe smaller misdemeanors? Or, I mean, does it seem to match?
That the way you just described prisons is absolutely in line with the sort of best practices of the field at the moment. But what we're finding is actually a lot of people, there is evidence for people using the prison as a site of punishment and sentencing people to specific timed sentences. I mean, we even have one papyrus saying like, this person committed a crime. They were sent to this place for 5 years. They've now served their sentence and this is their document of release.
Oh, wow.
So we have that kind of stuff. And then the kind of standard line that comes from a guy named Theodore Mommsen, among others, is that Romans just didn't really use prisons except for exactly what you said, like a short stay.
That's what I was told as an undergrad. Yeah.
And you were being given the best information available. And what we're finding is reason to question that and sort of push against that. And what I would say is we actually don't know how long Paul was in prison based on his letters. It could have been days, it could have been weeks, months, or years. And depending upon how you read Philippians or the composition, the integrity of Philippians, it may have been quite some time. Hmm. In the Acts of the Apostles, you get a picture of Paul where he's left in the prison in Caesarea Maritima for 2 years. And this actually would very much map onto what we would know about practices of incarceration in the Roman period, where a Roman administrator is just kind of like, you know what? It is to my political advantage, or I just flat out like it to not hear this person's trial. And so I will leave them there. And he's said to be left there for 2 years. And one of the arguments that I make in this manuscript I'm trying to finish, one of the manuscripts I'm finishing, is that Christians experienced incarceration as a punishment partly because of the legal ambiguity that surrounded their situation.
I was going to ask, like, was there a crime that they had committed, or were you think they were just being held, you know, like you said, without a trial as their punishment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm teaching Paul, a course on Paul now, and we're going through Philippians, and I think the standard view is like, well, Paul's in prison because the Romans didn't like him because he was a Christian, and you're like, well, What if Christianity doesn't exist yet as we know it? Christ belief certainly does, but maybe Christianity doesn't really, isn't like a thing. And if it was, it wasn't like illegal to be one. In which case, how do we understand why Paul's in prison? And so I think it takes a little bit of a different shape. Well, can I tell you, would you abide my own reading?
Oh, yeah, we want your reading.
Well, I think it's unique. But I read Philippians to say, I won't get into the details, but basically I think in 1:17, we've been misreading it. And we've been misreading it because we think the Romans incarcerated Paul because he was a Christian. But a better way to translate that verse is that other Christ believers who are preaching Christ out of false allegation have tried to raise up trouble for Paul by instigating his incarceration. And so I think the way we translate this phrase, that's usually they're trying to raise trouble for me during my incarceration. I think we've mistranslated it, and we've mistranslated it because we're not ready to think about other Christ believers being the one who instigate his arrest. But it's the exact same kind of grammatical structure that we see in 1:14, where we translate it the same way, that it's this in the instrument that is causing the thing is the incarceration. So if we translate it that way, the reason why Paul's in prison is because, kind of like we see in Galatians, he walked on someone else's turf and they didn't like what he was doing. They didn't like his gospel. And then you look at the rest of the letter, and I think it's some kind of charge of financial embezzlement, abuse of some kind. And, you know, Helen and your viewers will know it's really hard to date Philippians. But we also know that probably around this time, Paul is dealing with a Jerusalem collection.
Yeah.
He's going to Macedonia and Achaia and Asia and probably other places and saying two things at the same time. I'm not taking any of your money for myself so that I can offer you the gospel for free. And also, please give me your money so that I can give it to other people. And you can imagine, it's not hard for me to imagine. And here's where I'm kind of doing a little bit of, this is my theory, not a fact I can prove. If people really don't like Paul, they don't like his message, and he's constantly walking around asking people for money, but then living on that money in some sense, but also not using it, people being like, this guy, it's not hard how you then connect the dots and be like, this is how he ends up in prison, right?
Wow.
So those are the basic pieces that I put together, that Paul's trying to be a freelance skene toeos, which is usually translated tent maker, but I think is not right. And during the day and at night, he's trying to organize these communities of pagans for the end of time. And he's collecting money. He's saying he's not using the money. He's probably also using the money for some things. And people are like, hey, local sheriff, arrest this guy. That's at least that's the read I take. And it's, your viewers should be cleared on, that's not the standard view of the field. That's a view that I'm willing to argue for.
It's fascinating.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, so many of these things, you start off thinking it's sort of highfalutin theology and theological differences. But when it actually comes down to it, it's real people who just get annoyed and, you know, have their own egos and so many things like that.
Yeah. And this is fresh on my mind because I taught this with my students today, a few hours ago. And what we talked about is if you take this view, it really makes a much more complex picture of both incarceration and Paul and these first generations of Christ believers, you know. And of course, we know there's diversity, but it makes it a little, it takes the temperature and turns it up a little bit more. And it also, that would map onto very much what we know about how prisons worked, which is it's about crime and punishment in a technical sense. For most people, it's about money, it's about power, it's about local politics, and the last thing you want to be, is a non-elite person incarcerated in a prison outside your hometown, because you're going to have a hard time, and you're going to be very much swimming upstream at every turn.
So tell us about this sort of, I mean, it sounds like from what you say that prisons are pretty sort of permeable. So visitors can actually come. You've got that hole, the window into the street where people can pass food and things like that. And is that how most people got their food and clothes or anything like that? Is that how it works? You're sort of dependent on friends rather than sort of a prison warder coming and giving you what you need?
Yes and no. That again is the sort of the answer that I got when I first started reading on this mm-hmm. is like, if you don't have friends in the area, you will starve to death. And I'm sure yeah. in some sense that that is true. But actually, I was surprised to find that we have sources going all the way back to the second and I think third century BCE that talk about prison rations. And there seems mm-hmm. to be a sort of common cultural assumption about if you're in prison, you are going to get rations. But it's kind of like the analogy we use in that my co-writer on one of the manuscripts, Mark Letney at the University of Washington, that we use is in modern, at least American prisons, you have there's a whole study on prison being prison food being used as a kind of punishment itself. So like it's enough nutrition to keep you alive, but it's really closely calibrated so that it is punitive, that it's punitive food. Yeah. That you can't, I mean, it would almost be, you know, it's not starving you to death, but it is punishment.
Oh, I need examples. I need to understand how disgusting this food was. Do we know what the rations were?
In the ancient world?
Yeah.
We have different sources and of course it varies, you know, but it's basically like, it's really hard to calculate an exact percentage, but, and I'm going off memory here, but something for scale, like 1,000 calories of like stale bread. And like water that is probably going to make your tummy hurt, let's say.
At least. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you also have sources that talk about like, yeah, I mean, they gave us bread, but like I'm sitting in a cesspool of feces. And yeah. So it's, you know, I mean, listen, the viewers and listeners are going to be able to quickly put the dots together here that like, yes, you were given food, but on the same time, you do have tons of sources that say, if someone doesn't bring me basic necessities, I'm going to die in prison. So I think, and I think both were true. I mean, I don't think we need to say like, oh, well, it says they didn't have necessities, so they're going to die. Mm. They must not have been given. I think they were given food and it was terrible. Right. And they felt that they were going to die. And they were in a place that from a, you know, what we would call public health point of view would have not been safe, extremely bluntly or mildly.
I mean, presumably life expectancy couldn't be very long in a prison anyway.
No, I assume not. And yet we have lots of sources that people being like, hey, I've been in here for 3 years. I've been in here for 5 years. We have evidence of people serving a prison sentence inside an alabaster mine for 5 years, surviving and being released. 5 years.
Wow.
You know, so people did survive this. And based on that procedure, I have to assume this guy wasn't the only one. We have at least three of these that talk about people being sent as prisoners to the mines, surviving and being released.
I think they were a little tougher. They might have been a little tougher than us back then. I don't think I wouldn't have lasted 2 weeks. But yeah, these guys are tough. I'm interested. I mean, while we're inside this cell, because I think we're getting a picture, we're getting the odors, they throw the stale bread on the ground. You're like, no, thanks. Were prisoners also shackled? Have you found in the archaeological evidence something that shows you that was that part of the punishment?
Yeah. And here's a place where the archaeological record and the legal record can kind of talk to each other. Mm-hmm. As a preliminary note, the term for incarceration is chains. Oh. So you'd be like, I'm in chains, meaning I'm incarcerated. It may not mean I'm physically shackled. It's just the way the language worked, right? So, so that's one point. Legal sources talk about when and when you should not shackle people and how heavy the shackles could be, which implies that people were in a prison, but not necessarily, it raises the possibility that people were in some kind of a place of incarceration and not shackled. And one of these sites that we were studying and creating a model of in Pompeii was in the gladiator barracks. And in some sense, all of these cells would have been carceral, let's say, because these people were legally slaves and this is where they had to be. So their cell is kind of their prison, right? But there was one where there was a beam in the room with shackles attached to it. affixed to it. And this is one of the ways you can kind of identify a prison, that if it's part of the kind of built environment of the room, not just a shackle laying in the corner, it's very, very likely to be a prison. The shackles were there in the room as a part of the environment. And yet they found four skeletons in the room that were not shackled. So what that tells us is they had the capacity to lock them in this room and shackle them, but what they had done was lock them in the room and not shackle them. So it actually shows us the possibility that someone's in prison. You know, so I'm in a hotel room right now in Sweden, but
no shackles,
no shackles, none okay. that I can tell of.
Not yet.
But you can imagine something affixed to the wall here, and the door is locked, and there's a capability that to attach me to the wall, but I'm not attached to that. You know, so it's possible that Paul says in my chains, by which he means I'm locked inside a prison cell, and he's not physically attached to the wall. So, but again, you know, with Paul's letters, he's more speaking from the context of prisons rather than telling us what it's like inside of one.
Yeah. I feel like I read something in one of your papers that, like, once these people were released, we found evidence of like long-term effects of being shackled, right? Like people talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, in some sense we also know just like psychologically, a very short amount of time in prison can have really long-term, like mental, physical damage on people, and their bodies and their mental state. But also we have people talking about, the kind of long-term deforming of their arms or feet. We have one, prisoner who wrote on a broken piece of pottery called an ostracon, that his limbs have been so disabled that he's not able to move. And then he uses, it's in Coptic, a phrase, so that I have to make water underneath myself, meaning he's basically soiling himself because he's been immobilized by the shackles. And this is part of what the Roman legislation was trying to address, is when and why and how much is it right to shackle somebody?
So Paul was certainly able to write letters when he was in prison, and presumably he's not got, I mean, he won't have the means to write there, and anyway, that's not his practice. So he's dictating through the window, is he? And is this something that you find elsewhere, that educated people keep in contact with letters or even writing tracts and other things?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would take out is educated. We have, you know, this is kind of one of these beautiful moments when you're teaching the content and your students teach you something about the thing you're teaching them. But they were like, we've seen like dozens of letters from prisoners who are like, their occupation is like a grain measurer. And it's clear that this is a draft. And then another one says it's a copy. And on the other side, they have another draft. And so presumably, you've got two drafts just made in the prison, and then a letter that was probably sent to an administrator, you know? So someone who has, I would, very likely illiterate person with very unlikely to have financial access to, they're not financially elite. They're able to get a letter out. And when they do, that letter is produced in at least triplicate. And we've got lots of examples of this. So, you know, for me, this, in the 20th century, it was really common to think of Philippians as a compilation of letters. And then this fell out of vogue when kind of the rise of literary criticism. But for me, it's quite long. It's really long, actually, for a prison letter. And if you assume this context where anyone can get a letter out, and when it does, it's made like three copies. And then presumably whoever received it also made a copy. Then all of a sudden, it's less crazy to imagine all these letters somehow being kind of like dossiered together.
That makes me, it just makes me picture a whole, you know, industry of sort of scribes that people pass. I can picture people like walking by the windows, like, anybody want to dictate a letter? Anybody got to say anything? And they're reading the letters that come to them. That's pretty interesting image. Isn't it?
One of the things that my co-author Mark Letney and I explore is the scribe role. And we're probably not able to prove, because this is a very difficult thing to do, but we think we've got at least a pretty good case for a scribe made at least two of these letters. So this is from, let's say, prisoner A, it's their letter, and prisoner B, it's their letter, but both letters were made by the same scribe.
Mm.
And this is based on like stock phrases and handwriting and ligatures and all this stuff. So we can't prove that, but I think it's likely in, and if that's the case, then what you have is this sort of cottage industry of,
yeah,
hey, I'm a scribe. I need to go scare up some business. I'm going to head down to the prison because I know everyone down there would love to get at least two letters out. Sure. And the data on this is pretty thin. We've only got a couple examples, and they're from like really spread out time-wise. But we have examples of basically like the equivalent of a collect call, where it's like, please send this letter, and the person who receives it will pay.
They have to pay.
I was just going to ask how they get paid for this. So yes. It's the receiver. It's like when the postman turns up and says, there's not enough postage on this. Do you want
exactly,
it or not?
Exactly. Exactly. And it's, you know, I need to be clear. Like, I've got like two examples, and one's from like the 6th century CE and one's from the BC period. And so I can't prove this, but at least if someone asked me, how does like poor Phineas, the grain measurer, get multiple letters out? That would at least be one explanation that makes sense is, well, the scribe comes, he's making all these letters. And when he delivers them or someone delivers them, that's where they're getting paid.
Yeah.
Well, this is perfect because I've been writing a movie in my mind every time we do a podcast episode and it shines light. We got some kind of first century story. There's a dog involved. But now, when there's a prison, we have to have these characters who are these scribes that are, yeah, scaring up business at the windows and charging people in a couple shekels to get their letter through. Anyway, fascinating. And
holding their nose while they do it. Exactly. Yeah. But I've got to ask you about female prisoners, yeah, because we, yeah, keep talking about Paul and the, yeah, chaps. But I mean, we do know, certainly, don't we, from Romans 16, Paul talks about Junia and Andronicus, and they've been in prison with him. So are we imagining then that women are in the same rooms as the men? They're also shackled, everything's the same. But I mean, I can't imagine how awful it would be to be a female in this environment.
We have, yes. I mean, so the short answer is we've got evidence for exactly this. And not only women, but women with their children in these spaces. And from what we can tell, at least during this period, there wouldn't have been a sort of women's prison where women are kept separate from men. It's interesting to me, one of the things that I'm exploring in, I've got two manuscripts, one on basically prisons and one on Christians in prisons. In the Christians in prisons book, the major theme is like, how do you go from the basic assumption that John the Baptist, of Jesus of Nazareth, that like prisons are real and they're probably going to target you, and if you get thrown in one, you're likely to die in it, to prisons being the one administering the prisons? And how does that sort of progression happen? And so it's a kind of a cultural history. But one of the things that happens is you have these Christians that bring about these prison reforms. And one of them is that you need to have a separate quarter for the women, that the women are kept in a separate space. And it's presumed to sort of protect their integrity, their bodily integrity. But yeah, so that's the first part of the question. But about Junia, yeah, it's in Romans 16, and he refers to them as their sun aikmelotes, his fellow prisoners of war. And so the question there is, well, what does it mean to be a prisoner of war? Let me just raise a couple ideas. One is, it's not like a desmois would be the normal term for a prisoner, but this is aikmelotes. So it's a prisoner of war, which can be used of normal prisoners, but it may have a war capture connotation. Oh. And I think that's right. I should have double checked this before the podcast. I'm pretty sure.
I have no idea. I cannot correct you. You're right. I think you're right.
One of the viewers can look it up in their Nestle Island and tell me if I've made that up, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Looking it out of mine here.
The other one is, he says, my fellow prisoners. Mm. And the only other thing, well, there's two other things we know about Junia, is one, that she's well known among the apostles, and two, that she was in Christ before Paul.
Mm.
And you know what that at least raises the possibility for me? And Helen and I have had many conversations. She knows I'm prone to kind of like new ideas. is it possible that my fellow prisoners means they, Andronicus and Junia, are fellow prisoners, and the my refers to Paul, that they're Paul's prisoner? If they're in Christ before Paul, that at least raises the possibility that he had taken them captive.
He had put them in prison. Wow.
I absolutely cannot prove that. I've tried.
That's true, because we know from way back, or at least in the biography of Paul, he was the persecutor as Saul, and he was throwing people in prison.
Wow. Yeah, so you have him described that way in Acts, and then he also says that he persecuted the church.
In Galatians.
In Galatians, in his own letters. So at least, I just want to let listeners know, we don't know this, but it's possible to read that as, they were in Christ before me, and they were fellow prisoners of me. As the imprisoner. That's at least a possibility. But what it would otherwise mean is that based on the biography, chronology, timeline of Paul, he probably is not imprisoned. Well, actually, I can't say that, because he goes to Arabia for 3 years initially, and he's causes something of a stir such that King Aretas finds out he's in Damascus and has the whole city shut down to try to capture him. So maybe he got arrested earlier, but we don't really have much evidence that he was too much of a troublemaker in Antioch in Syria. But certainly once he heads out into the provinces of Galatia and Asia and Macedonia and Achaia, that's where we have evidence that he's running into trouble and getting in prison. So if he's in prison there, then we would need to imagine, if they're in prison with him, then I would want to place it in somewhere in that time period, which makes them really interesting figures, because then we can kind of say they're in Christ before Paul. So this is like 31. Wow. I mean, they're like among the first, like
even the time of Jesus, maybe
100 people. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like who are a part of this movement. They're like, you know, they got in at the ground level and they're in the C-suite, let's say. And then, you know, 20 years, 25 years later, they're in a prison with Paul. So it's unfortunately, that's the only verse we have about her. Maybe we'll find more in the Herculaneum Library or in Oxyrhynchus. But
that's great. See what you can find. Yeah, exactly. But Richard Borkum, you know, has that suggestion that Junia is actually a sort of a Latinized version of Joanna in Luke's Gospel, the wife of Chusa, Herod Steward. So that would give her a whole backstory. Yeah, but anyway, this is about prisons.
Yeah, well, something you mentioned earlier, and we have to dig into. You said the alabaster mines. You talked about
somebody
who was sentenced for 5 years and actually got out. But man, tell us about this type of incarceration and why it was extremely rare for someone to survive such an experience.
Yeah, so a little bit of background before I get to the experience of the mines, because we've talked about like are ancient prisons like modern prisons, and the answer that I would have been given early in grad school and Helen gotten, others have gotten, is no, they're not. First of all, they're really small. Second of all, they're in the city. Third of all, you're not serving a sentence. And you maybe didn't even have like purpose-built architecture for it. And they didn't have anything like solitary confinement, so on and so forth. But actually, if you just tilt the lens a little bit, all those things really fall apart. So we've got tons of evidence of people. If you're rich and you commit a crime, you are exiled, which for a lot of people meant like you must go spend 3 years at your summer house.
Tough.
Yeah.
Wait, man, you're not trying to say that wealthy people had different treatment than poor people, because that doesn't line up with my current understanding of. No, I'm sorry. Keep going.
No, the only thing I got to say is you got to hand to the Romans that they're the ones who said, oh, yeah, we do for sure. Like, you know, a lot of societies today would be like, no, everyone's treated
exactly the same. They made it clear.
The Romans were like, no, we treat rich people differently. Of course.
Why wouldn't we?
But you would be sent to the mines. And if you look at the mines and you think of them as a site of incarceration, which is exactly how these sources talk about it. They'd be like, I was in the mines. Yeah, in the prison. And that's how they talk about it. Well, they're all of a sudden, they're quite large. We have examples of some that could hold up to maybe 1,000 people at one time. They're out in the middle of nowhere, much like modern American prisons. And you were often serving a specific time-limited sentence. And you were performing labor that benefited the state. You know, and all of a sudden, oh, that kind of doesn't sound that different than the modern prison, right? Mm-hmm. So, but to your point about alabaster, and surviving. A lot of these mines were, so alabaster is a specific kind of material, but if you're sent to a place where they're mining heavy metals like copper, then your survival rate is going to go down, right? Because the mining practice of copper is toxic. And whereas alabaster is a different situation. I see someone did find Sun Aikmelotus Moi. Yeah. that would be a different situation. And like, you know, you don't want to go to either of these, but if you had to pick between being sent to an alabaster mine, which is a really kind of a soft white material, you would want to go there rather than a copper mine where it's a toxic material, or the process of smelting it and mining it is toxic.
Mm-hmm. And what about sort of military prisons? I think for a long time there was no evidence that there were prisons inside Roman military encampments, was there? But I think you found one in Algeria, is that right? And what alerted you to the fact that this is a prison?
Yeah, we did. It's the first Roman military prison that's been identified, and it's in a place called Lambesis, Algeria, which is maybe 100 kilometers or so inland from the Mediterranean coast. And essentially, I went with Mark Letney to create a model and to study two different sites there that had been identified as archaeologists in the 20s as prisons, and we wanted to kind of check those out. And getting into Algeria is at least not easy for an American, especially. And so while we were there, we just got to see everything we can. And so we went to one place, to Lambesis. And what actually alerted us is the local prison guard, or I'm sorry, the local archaeology site guard.
Did he feel like a prison guard?
Yeah, I guess so. He was like, Sijin. Sijin, which is the Arabic word for prison, and pointed in this direction. And it's a very complicated story, because I'm not sure exactly what he meant. But the site we identified had been called a treasury. And this is because it was right. If anyone listening to this is like a gamer, you've probably seen Roman military represented, and it's the people like the standard, where you've got the big flag with the eagle on the top and the fabric piece coming down, where you would have set that as a shrine. Underneath that, it was thought, and often is a treasury. So we went to the site and they said, it's a prison. And we're like, oh, okay. And we're like, no, it's not, it's a treasury. And then we started looking around, and I think what he actually meant was, directly behind it is a prison that was built during the French colonization of Algeria. And the site was excavated by Algerian prisoners a long time earlier. And what alerted us to the fact that we're not dealing with a treasury is, one, there's windows about this big opening up to the public street, and such that you could easily reach your entire arm inside, but not get a body out. And it's high up. So it's kind of like, that's a funny thing to have, like, for a treasury. Like, why would you have a treasury open to the public street in a way that anyone can just stick their arm in there? And then we noticed that there was like a really strong, what the initial archaeologist called a stout locking device, opening up to an initial chamber that opened up into five different cells. And each of those cells had their own door and locking device. And then the other key bit was, we found in each cell a lot of graffiti and on the main corridor chamber. So what that tells us is it's a place where people spent time with rudimentary tools to make markings on the wall with access to the open street. And then that led us to go to the literary record and say, wait, why did we ever think this was a treasury? And there are some sources that talk about that, and we have other sites in military camps where the treasury is under the is in that kind of place. But we actually have lots of sources that talk about people being incarcerated underneath the where the standards are held. So that's what led us to make that identification. And what's interesting about Roman military prisons, and I think listeners should be clear on this, it's more about who's doing the imprisoning than who is being imprisoned. So this is not just a prison for soldiers. It's a prison that happens to be in the middle of a military camp and probably run by soldiers. So like Perpetua is in a military prison, not because she's in the military or committed a military crime, but because that's where she needed to be held. And it happened to be in a Roman military camp. And basically the Roman military is like, most of the time, they're not like fighting epic battles like we see in the movie Gladiator. Like most of the time, they were probably like building a road and like serving as police for the, you know, some far flung province where they found themselves.
That makes sense. You, I can't pass over the graffiti thing. So what kind of graffiti? I mean, how do you, I guess if people are going to be in a place for a long time, they're just going to sketch something into the wall. But like, what tells you that, that this graffiti was made by people who were somewhere for a long time? Or like, what are some examples?
In this particular one, the site is pretty poorly preserved, so it's hard to make out a lot of like words. We have like, you know, parts of words being written, and what we have in this one is people making lines, which we have from other prisons, but is probably something like, I would guess, a timekeeping device. Other prisons have different kinds of graffiti. The one in Corinth has stuff that sounds, let's say, not very Apostle Paul-like. It's things like, Lord Jesus Christ, do not have any mercy on the people who threw us into this lawless place.
That's fair.
Or, Lord, please make, implied my accusers, die an awful death. You know, so it's actually in some ways more relatable, you know, like stuff.
Super relatable. That's what I would do.
Yes, me too.
So you have that kind of stuff. You have one in Sardinia, in Cagliari, the Roman city of Corrales. And there's an amphitheater where people would have been held who had been condemned, and before they go into the amphitheater to be, to fight the beast or whatever they were going to do. We have evidence that they were anchored and chained to the wall, and probably sitting on a Roman platform, a wooden platform, excuse me. And behind them, they wrote a graffiti with a ship where the mast is clearly a Cairo, or the a kind of early Christian symbol for the first two letters of Christ. And then hanging from the mast, there's an alpha and an omega. And then there's oars coming out of the boat into the water. And guess how many there are? There are 12. You know, so it's clearly a Christian. It's someone who's influenced by Christian theology. And this is probably the last self-expression that they made before losing their life. So we have all different kinds of graffiti. I mean, oftentimes it's like just a drawing of a soldier or someone's face or a doodle. Someone drew a donkey or a dog. Or, you know,
did I see somewhere like almost like a game board, maybe something was like a grid that maybe they played games on or something?
That's exactly right. We have game boards, you know, which also at first sounds like, huh, that's interesting. You're like, actually, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. If these people are just like, there's a lot of time, and it's a community board. So those are the different kinds of things that we've seen. Mm-hmm.
And what did you say about solitary confinement? Was that one of the things that people said there wasn't, but now you think there is, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, I think people would have said like, well, if they didn't have prisons and they didn't have prison sentences, they obviously didn't have solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we see different literary sources where, like in Suetonius, so early first quarter of the second century, he's writing about the life of the emperor Tiberius, who set almost a century earlier. And he talks about he didn't like him. And one of the reasons that he describes why he didn't like him is he would always send people to prison and just leave them there for long periods of time, 5-7 years. And he says he would incarcerate them in a way that they were not able to read their books or read or have any conversation with other people.
Oh, wow.
It's not clear how he would have done that from an architecture point of view. But I don't know exactly what else to call that except for solitary confinement. Mm. And we have other different sources. We have one that is talked about from a monastic context. And if you're interested in incarceration in the ancient world, especially as it relates to a thesis about monastic confinement, I'd recommend Julia Hillner's book on the topic. But there's a monastic source from a guy named Pacomius. Maybe we can write his name in the chat if listeners are interested. But he talks about a guy, he would make people make mats every day. And one guy decided one day he was going to make two mats, and he was very proud of it. So he made two mats, and Pacomius thought that that was really showy and tacky and bad. So he sentenced him to be locked in his own cell for a specific amount of time and to be put on reduced food rations. And, you know, I don't know exactly what else to call that. It's not solitary confinement in our sense, but I don't know what other like term really captures what that is, except for being confined in a solitary way, you know, and that being alone is part of the punishment.
Yeah. And the thing that said it was dark, would that imply no window? Because I think for me, that would be even worse if you were in darkness and nobody else there. I think that would be really pretty horrible.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It would be psychologically terrorizing for sure. And something that is now recognized by most governments and the UN as a form of torture.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, by the time the Gospels are written, sometime maybe a little bit later than some of the period we're talking about with Paul and stuff like that, it's baked into the gospel of Jesus, right? That you minister to people who are in prison. There's the famous parable of the king, right? Where Jesus says, you know, the king, you know, you came and you fed me when I was hungry, you clothed me when I was naked, you visited me in prison, and those are the people that will be blessed. So does it seem to you from literary sources and other sources that, you know, early Christians took that kind of admonition to heart? Like, were they the people who were, you know, coming to the prisons and giving food and helping people? What do we see?
Yeah, we have the source in Matthew 25 where the parable of the sheep and the goats and the people who served people who were in prison were in fact in that parable being told to be serving Christ. You know, so then right. You have this admonition. And in the epistle to the Hebrews, it says that you're supposed to take care of prisoners and visit them and treat them as though you were imprisoned with them. And this does become a sort of thing that Christians are known for, and an almost a stereotype of Christians. You have a source in the second century by a guy who, he was a satirist. So this is kind of like think of Stephen Colbert, if the audience remembers him before he was on the Tonight Show. He had a satirical news show. So this is kind of in that genre, but he basically tells this story. And part of it is Christians are always outside the prison because they're just dying for people to take care of. And he then portrays them as very gullible. And they're like good-hearted people who are very gullible. So that seems to be a sort of other way of looking at the same side. And yet part of what I'm also looking at is, given that you have parables like that, and you have Jesus teaching in Matthew and Luke, where it says, like, if someone arrests you, you should try to get out of there, because if you get thrown in prison, you're going to be held there until you pay the last penny, assuming basically till you die. You have that, you have this admonition to take care of prisoners. Then how do you get to where the prisoner is glorified and incarceration is practiced by Christians? You know, by the sixth century, you have a bishop in Gerasa who's building and dedicating the prison. You know, so how do you get, I mean, they almost sound like complete inversions of each other. But one of the things that I'm trying to track is, how does that progression happen? And in big and small ways, you have a sort of abstract and spiritualization of the prison, and then this kind of distancing as the prisoner from an us to the prisoner as a them. And just as a part of that progression, there's a source that New Testament scholars love to read that I think the general public should know about. And it's called the Epistola Apostolorum. And it's a letter that claims to be written by the apostles about Jesus. It's probably from later, and we can probably date it because it says the Lord is coming back 120 years after his ascension.
Which happens to be in 2 weeks from now.
Exactly. So you've got it exactly right. So most people are like, I think that was written around 150. Probably was. But it has actually an Easter or a Passover, a Pascha liturgy, and it probably is the oldest Christian Passover or Easter liturgy that we have. And what it says that you're supposed to do on Passover is take one of the members of the congregation and place them in prison for 3 days. And then at the vigil, they come out and proclaim the gospel, and then they go back into the prison, and then they come out on Easter morning to be released, right? So you have this like tight calculation of death and resurrection with incarceration and release that are being brought together. But at the same time, you also have the prison being kind of made more abstract and more spiritual rather than an absolute physical threat to people's bodies, you know? I mean, what would it, like, can you imagine if you belong to a religious community, to a church, and Easter rolls around and people are like, great. All right, Samantha, you're the one who's going to be in the prison for 3 days this Easter, because that's just what we do for our liturgy. And you know, I can understand why that didn't make it, through the millennia to practicing Christian communities today, but that's probably the oldest Easter liturgy that we have. And that's one of the central features of what these first generations of Christians were doing with the prison.
Wow, that's fascinating. And what about martyrdom? I mean, is there any sense that sort of Christians are embracing incarceration as part of martyrdom once you get to sort of those activities a bit later on?
Certainly. And then it becomes interesting, you know, people almost want to be in the prison because then the prison becomes a site of kind of, if you die in prison, then you're a martyr. So it's almost a guaranteed way if you're looking for that kind of social capital, you know. So I think immediately of Ignatius of Antioch, the bishop of Antioch in the beginning of the second century, where he's like, hey, listen, folks, please do not try to get me released because I'm really trying to maintain my status as a prisoner all the way to Rome so that I can be eaten in the amphitheater. And so that becomes an important aspect of his identity as he's presented in these letters that we have, the letters of Ignatius of Antioch. But at the same time, I imagine for a lot of people who are in prison, Christians, they had a different attitude, you know, and they would like, I'd actually just like to be released if you don't want
to be frank.
my great preference. And one of the things that I've noticed and that we've tracked and we're writing about in this book is in the Roman system, you had a whole hierarchy of prison staff. So there's not just one guy out there with a sword. It's six, seven people. And one of these people would have been the guy who's keeping records. And one of the things they did was they made a record of who died in the prison each day. And so we have one that said, this person had bought the rights to this tax and they didn't pay it. So they got thrown in prison. And then 56 days later, they died in prison on today. And so it's official part of the like political records. And around the exact same time, we get letters from Cyprian saying, I'm sending someone to the prison every day to keep a track of who's dying. And when they die, their names are being added to this list of people who are commemorated each year. So it's sort of a martyrdom. So this kind of martyrdom calendar is related in some ways to this prison registration system of who's dying, you know? And I imagine for some people like that, it seems less kind of literature and more kind of real people's lives who are not as invested in getting the social capital that comes with martyrdom and more just prisoners.
Well, this is incredible. I mean, we started our conversation with you saying that the established, you know, scholarship around prisons was prisons are a modern invention, full stop. And then you go on to say that there's no archaeological evidence for, you know, a military prison or anything like that. I mean, from what you were learning as part of the prison project, like, is this all about to change? Like, are we about to have a completely different understanding of prisons in the ancient world?
I mean, I think so. I guess I need to leave that to other people to determine. That's not my lane. But I think there's a chance that that's going to happen. At least my perception of it has strongly changed. And where I think this plays out is how we read texts, how we read biblical texts, how we read ancient history in general, and how we understand the history of the prison. You know, a world without prisons is a world that it is up to us to make, if that is something that we wish to do, for people who want to argue for the abolishment of prisons. What this history does is not so much give us an answer for how prisons ought to be constructed, but more holds up a mirror for us to see the ways in which modern society uses prisons and gives us more of a self-awareness of some of the things that we've done and decisions that we've made that felt obvious and natural and unavoidable, but that are in fact really contextualized to where we're at in different modern societies.
Hmm. All right. Well, Helen, should we tell Matt about what he gets to do? I mean, all of
our guests. Well, I don't know. Yeah. Do you want to do that? Or do you want, we have one or two questions, I think, on the chat. Do we want to do the questions or do we want to go straight to our...
Well, let's let Matt answer his time travel question and then we'll take some, chat questions for sure. But yeah, Matt, you know, if you've listened to the podcast, you know that we have a fully functioning time machine. You are aware of the dangers, as you've already talked about, of going back, you know, 2,000 years. But if you could bring your own food and water, you know, a little first aid kit, whatever you need, where and when would you want to go? It's a big opportunity.
Man. How long do I have to stay?
It's up to you. Long. The longer you stay, the worse outcomes. That's what we have found, unfortunately, with past guests. So just take that into consideration.
If I could, I am deeply fascinated right now by the biography of Paul, and I would love to know more about what is happening in his world around the years like 41 to 42. That's probably where I'd want to go. Because it seems to me he's some kind of an understudy, maybe of Barnabas in Antioch, but then he claims, depending upon when you date 2 Corinthians, somewhere around 41, 42, to be drawn up into the third heaven and be given a vision of things that he cannot describe. And we just don't know anything about that time period. And I would love to be like, what is happening right now? But I'm kind of just low-key obsessed with the biography of Paul. I definitely wouldn't pick a prison because they would be uniformly awful unless you could kind of just look in one for 30 seconds and then be like, okay, that was great. But you know, for me, I'm like interested in this to shed light on the topic, but I'm not interested in the same way that like people are interested in like, you know, C.S. Lewis or something where it's like, I would actually like to be friends with him. And like, it's like, I'm interested in this because I think it's horrific.
So you'd walk past and see those scribes kind of trying to jot things down and all those Christians trying to sort of give them food and you just say, move over, let me just have a quick look.
I know, it's when you put it that way, it's such a like a thorny ethical question. It's like, hello, I'm here from the future to study you. Like, they're like, can you help? Like, nope, I'm actually writing a book.
No, I just want to take a picture if I can. Just, that's it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is excellent. Yeah, like we have, I think it does. I see one question in the chat.
One question, yes.
From Earl. Let's see. What is the significance that Paul is guarded by the Imperium? Is this group connected directly to Rome and the Emperor?
Yeah. I mean, this gets us back to Philippians, where I think it's 1:13, where he talks about his incarceration is known to the whole praetorium. And it was thought that this must therefore be in Rome because that's where the praetorian guard was. But actually we have sites that are called praetorium or praetoria in the plural. And those are in fact all over Roman provinces. And it was thought that those were only in capitals of Roman provinces. So like Thessaloniki, Ephesus, Corinth, but there's a site in Dion, or there's a place in Dion, which is maybe an hour and a half outside of Thessaloniki, towards Athens, and they have a praetorium there, and it's not a capital. So probably what it means is that he is being held in some kind of military-run prison. Not because he's a soldier or committed a military crime again, but because that the place wherever he was, they happened to have some room for him in that prison. So I think that's the significance. I don't think it's that. The kind of theory is he's in Rome. It's a Praetorian Guard because he's about to be heard in Rome and he's facing capital punishment. And to me, I think there's all kinds of historical reasons for thinking twice about that way of looking at it.
Wow. Oh, we just had another question come in. You want to read that one, Helen?
Yeah. Well, just to say thank you again to Laura. Hello, Laura, for putting in the Greek of Romans 16:7.
Yeah.
And we've just got another one from Jeffrey. Do we have record of enslaved people being imprisoned other than Perpetua's passion? Were they imprisoned differently?
We do. And I can't think of a source that says person A is imprisoned and person B is imprisoned and person B is a slave and they're treated differently in this way. But we have lots of evidence of slaves being imprisoned. We have one letter where a woman, sort of a tragic, haunting story, is sort of playing the markets. She has a debt and she's waiting for the price on the thing that she sells to go up. And in the meantime, she has left all of her slaves to be in prison. And she's writing a letter to her child to say, don't forget to feed the slaves or else they're going to die.
Oh, jeez.
That is some evidence. The story about Perpetua and Felicity, who is a slave, does not strike me as historically odd in any way. The one way where slaves are treated differently is you have specific slave prisons. And these would have not been civic prisons. They would have been like in the basement of a villa or something like that. And or if you're running a large, like a villa rustica, basically a big farm, you would have had some, or a bakery, you would have had people, some slaves who needed to be imprisoned or this person felt they needed to be incarcerated. And then you would have had specific prisons for them. And we have evidence of this in Pompeii, such as it's called the Villa of the Mosaic Columns, because archaeologists are very clever and name buildings after exactly what they are. And there's this one building that has great mosaic columns. So that's what this villa is called. And then in the basement underneath that, affixed to the wall were two shackles, and inside those shackles were tibia. And so based on the fact that it's a house, and someone's obviously incarcerated there, that's usually regarded as what's called an ergustulum, which is usually translated as a slave prison.
Mm. Wow. See, we always joke about Indiana Jones stuff on the show. Matt, he's kind of living the Indiana Jones life. If you're finding shackles with tibia hanging from them, next thing, the bugs all come out of the walls and stuff like that.
And the Holy Grail. The Grail will be there.
I didn't find that one. That one.
You should say you found it. It would make it more interesting.
A long time ago, but yeah, it was an inclusive "we" that we. I did not find that one.
Sure. Shame.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you to our attendees and the folks who asked questions. But this will wrap up our first ever live recording of Biblical Time Machine. And we will see everyone back on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, everyone. This was a blast.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And there you have it, folks. Our first live taping of a Biblical Time Machine episode. Thanks again to Matthew Larson for joining us. We wanted to plug, Matt's got this cool series. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Nobody Liked Paul, which is a fun title. I think there's 6 episodes, these are kind of short episodes. They follow him on his Indiana Jones-like explorations around the Mediterranean. Maybe the first episode is on YouTube. We will put a link in the show description, and then you can get the rest of them on a service called Kava. I'm calling it Kava, Q-A-V-A. Anyway, if you want more of Matt, please check that out. Again, we will put the link in the show description, but we will see all of you on the next episode of Biblical Time Machine. Bye.